Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
So hello, everyone, and we're delighted to present All for One and One for All public seminar series on mental health in academia and society. So these seminar series will shine a light on and discuss mental health issues in academia across all levels, from student to faculty, as well as in wider society. Seminars are held online once per month on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. CET or 11 a.m. EST, and a free for all to attend. Speakers include academics, organizations, and health professionals whose work focuses on mental health. Live Q&A sessions will be held after each talk. And for live webinar schedule, please visit our Lashua Lab website, which is going to be in the comments and a blog post below. So feel free to post your questions and thoughts as we go along, and then we will present it to our speaker.
Good afternoon, everyone. Every day from the time we wake up until the time we sleep, we make so many choices and decisions that shape our daily routines and determine how happy or productive we are during the day. Study after study continue to highlight the physiological benefits of having a daily routine. Most of us have daily routines and habits, but not everyone takes the time to reflect and assess how our daily habits and routines impact our productivity, but also our physical and mental health. Therefore, we thought it's important to have a discussion on the science of the healthy living and our daily routines, and there isn't a better and more qualified person to help us achieve this than our guest today, Dr. Stuart Fairmount. Dr. Fairmount is a medical doctor, brain cancer survivor, an educator turned passionate science communicator and food scientist. He's the author of several bestseller books, including The Science of Cooking, published in 2017, Science of Spice in 2018, and the subject of our webinar today, The Science of Living, also sold as Live Your Best Life in North America. And as I mentioned to him earlier, I hope that today's conversation will inspire a fourth book on the science of mental wellness or mental resilience. He's a science and medical writer, presenter, and a regular guest on many TV, radio, and public events and programs. And his writings appears in national and international publications, including The Independent, The Daily Mail, New Scientist. Since 2017, he has been a food scientist for BBC, much-loved show Inside the Factory, hosted by Greg Wallace and Cherry Haley. He's an avid blogger. Stuart is also the founder and editor of online lifestyle science magazine Guru, which is supported by the Wellcome Trust, the world's largest medical research charity. His book, The Science of Living, 219 Reasons to Rethink Your Daily Routines, challenges many of the conventional thinking about our daily routines, but also provides facts, scientific insights, and tricks that empowers us to make changes that will help us improve our mental health and productivity. It's a great pleasure to have you with us today, Dr. Fairman, and welcome everyone. As Galena mentioned, so we will have a presentation by Dr. Fairman, followed by a conversation between the three of us. And during that time, we'll be happy to take any questions or comment from the audience. Thank you all for being with us, and the stage is yours, Dr. Fairman.
Thank you so much. That's a glowing welcome. So thank you. I feel very, very humbled for such an introduction. Entitled today's talk, The Science of Living, Understanding and Managing Stress. And I won't labour about who I am, but I've just put up a slide here to explain who I am. I've written three books, The Science of Cooking, The Science of Spice, and the book, The Science of Living, most recent one. In North America, it's called Live Your Best Life. And today we're going to be looking at, are we all really getting more stressed? And is stress bad for me? Is there a quick way to calm my nerves? How do I manage worrying thoughts? And how can I deal with constant stress? I'm going to ask you the question, are we all really getting more stressed? And this is the thing that we hear all the time of, we've constantly got this feeling of, everybody's getting more stressed. And in a survey in the United Kingdom in 2018, 74% of people in the UK said that they were too stressed to cope. But I want to ask you a question, is what actually is stress? Because, you know, people often say, how was your day? Oh, stressed or stressful. What did happen? Or this really stressful thing happened at work. Is stress the thing we're feeling, or is stress the thing that happens to us? Is it an event, a feeling, a bodily response? And I think the thing is that we all use this term, but we don't really understand what stress is. And so I'm going to explain to you what stress is. And importantly, its history, which is really fascinating, which you almost certainly haven't heard of. Stress, until the mid-20th century, the only people talked about stress were engineers when they were talking about the stresses on bridges. It entered our language in the mid-20th century as basically a way to explain away why modern life was apparently making us sick. And stress as a concept was the brainchild of a 29-year-old Hungarian-born scientist called Hans Selye. In the mid-1900s, he started writing about experiments that he did a bit earlier in the 1930s. And in these experiments, these were grisly lab experiments. This guy was just fascinated by the body and how it responds. Essentially, what he did was sounds gruesome, but he tortured thousands of rats in various brutal ways. So what he did is he tied them up, he broke their bones, he starved some of them he cut their spinal cords, some of them he exercised until they're exhausted, some of them he stabbed in the abdomen, others he injected with harmful drugs. And he did this to see what they would do to a whole range of different insults onto them. After two or more days of essentially tortured these animals, he'd kill them. He'd sacrifice them and open them and examine what was happening on the inside. And he observed that all the animals' innards, basically all their organs, had changed in the same way, regardless of what it was that they endured, whether it was exercising to exhaustion, starvation, injury. He saw that they all did a similar sort of thing. And what he saw was that the adrenal glands, which produce adrenaline, that enlarged, while another set of glands called the thymus glands, in us, they're just in our neck, or rather at the top of the heart. And they produced the rat's white blood cells, the defensive white blood cells. They shrunk. So essentially he's saying, this one's got bigger, this one's got smaller. There's something going on in the body that no matter what happens, this same thing is happening. And he called it the general alarm system. Later on, he then rebranded it, if you like, as the stress response. And that is where stress comes from. But he deduced basically from this experiment with the rats. And actually, when you go back and look at the details of his experiments and the measurements that he made, they wouldn't stand up to scrutiny today. But he deduced that because these rodents had responded in this way, all animals would do the same thing and humans would be included in this. And that we'd all internally try to weather any prolonged insult in much the same way. And Hans Selye, he was quite a character. He actually toured the globe researching. He did so much research, and he was essentially an evangelist for his his stress theory, and he would use it to explain why I had low energy levels and all sorts of medical problems that we had, stomach ulcers, arthritis, and heart disease. He was the first person to say, it's this out of control stress response that's causing all these problems. He actually wrote 39 books and had 17 Nobel Prize nominations, but not once did he get his Nobel Prize. So we owe the whole thing of stress largely to this guy. There were other researchers around there at the time, but he was the one who spearheaded it, went around the world and spoke all about stress. So that is where we get our concept of stress from. But I would tell you also that there's a twist in this tale, is that we found out after he died, there was a trove of declassified papers that revealed that Hans Selye had been enjoying basically lavish payouts from the tobacco industry to use his research to say that smoking was a way to reduce stress, and stress was this harmful thing causing all these modern ills. So if you smoke, you're going to reduce your stress and you'll be weller and you'll be healthier. So in the late 1960s, when he was doing this, he received a yearly award of $50,000. And today that'd be equivalent to $350,000 US. And in return, he testified in court to say that smoking was actually good for you, for helping to relieve stress. So that is the origin of stress. So I think that's really fascinating. And hopefully you can like sort of understand now, well, that's where this term stress comes from. Before that, we didn't have this concept of stress. So, but what actually is it? So what he found, and which is largely what you read in all the textbooks today of what is stress, is it's a series of things happen. So you have something that happens to you. So in days of yore, it would be a panther, you know, coming towards you, for example, some kind of threat to life and limb. We call that the stressor. That's the thing that triggers what he found, and he called the stress response. And a series of things happen in us. So the stress response, the first part of the stress response is also called the fight or flight response. And that is when our body has this instinct, this uncontrollable instinct to respond in a certain way to defend ourselves. So the first thing that happens is that in our brain, we recognize, specifically in a part of the brain called the amygdala, it picks up any threat. And from that, it sends out signals to the adrenal glands using a hormone called ACTH. That hormone then gets the adrenal glands fired up. They produce hormones, adrenaline, which you've probably all heard of. That's the thing that we're familiar with, is when we get excited, when our heart starts racing. That's adrenaline. Also another hormone called the stress hormone called cortisol. Those two things together produce a whole host of different things. We have our heart rate goes up, we breathe faster, our pupils open, and we become very focused on something. We have tunnel vision towards whatever it is that is in our mind that we need to do, be it get away, be it solve this problem. Let's say you're driving a car and something cuts up in front of you. All of a sudden, you get that surge of adrenaline and cortisol, but you feel it as your heart rate goes up, you breathe faster, you're focused on something. Also, what's going on inside of you is that your digestion slows down because your body is now focused on, I need to get out of this emergency situation. I don't need to worry about anything else. Your digestion slows down, you sweat more, and the liver, which stores a huge amount of energy for you in a form called glycogen, which is basically animal starch, our long-term store of sugars, it then kicks into action and starts turning it into sugar, so increasing our blood sugar, our blood glucose levels, to give us that extra fuel to survive. So these are the things that happen to us in our body. Liver converts glycogen to glucose, heart gets faster, we breathe faster, digestion slows down, we sweat more, our pupils open, and we get tunnel vision. Now that is what all the textbooks tell you. So they say whatever happens to you, these are the series of things that go on inside your body. But I say to you, our two stresses, in my opinion, and you might find this as well, it often feels quite different. So if I fall over, if I'm going for a jog and I trip over and I hurt myself, the response that I get from that is very different from if I've got to go and do some public speaking, for example, or if, for example, I, you know, have some very terrible news that or my dog dies or something, that stress is very different. And so what I would say to you is that the body is far more sophisticated than we give it credit for. And only now our research is starting to tease apart to say, actually, a body responds to this kind of stress in this way and this kind of stress in a different way, with a whole different sort of medley of hormonal responses to those stresses. So I share this with you so that when you read all the things about stress, as I am going to talk about here, you need to bear in mind that individual responses to individual situations can be very different. So no two stresses are the same. Being punched in the gut triggers a different biological response to the turmoil of a feud with a neighbor or the worry over a delayed paycheck. So I'm just going to give you some thoughts of different stresses, and there are terms in which we're now increasingly using so that we don't just label everything as stress. So let's say, for example, you're asked to quickly stand up and speak in front of a room of your colleagues, your peers, and to like tell them about your latest piece of research or what you're doing. That might be termed an acute time-limited stress. And I've got a little graph here. So basically shows you that the stress level or the stress response is low when normally, and then the event happens and the stress response goes up very quickly and then it dips again very quickly afterwards. So that would be an acute time-limited stress. So that would be, say, sudden pressure of public speaking or being put on the spot. Now imagine, for example, you're preparing for an exam. So you know it's coming, you've got lots to do, you know, you're thinking, I don't need to sleep as much, I need to get more done. This might be called a brief naturalistic stress. And the pattern of the stress response is different, is that it builds up slowly as we know the deadline is approaching, as we know the exam is getting near. And then when it passes, the stress response diminishes, it drops off straight away. You feel you're back to normal again. We all know what it's like. So that is called a brief naturalistic stress. That is very different, though, to, let's say, somebody dies, a relative dies, somebody love or somebody, or even just a pet, something terrible happens to you. That would be called a stressful event. But that would have a very different stress response to those others. You would have the stress response would go up very quickly, and then it would recede gradually over a period of time as you come to terms with whatever thing that has happened. So that could be a bereavement, experiencing a major natural disaster, or some sort of calamity that might happen to you. If you're in a bad relationship, for example, or your work, you're really not enjoying your work, it's really getting you down, that again is a different kind of stress pattern. We would call this a chronic stress. And in that, your stress response is going up and it's going down and it never really goes back down to baseline. So you constantly got this level of stress that is above what would be normal, what would be resting. So that would be a draining job, a messy divorce, a responsibility such as caring for a loved one. There's one other kind of stress. Now, chronic stress is never good for you. Neither is another kind of stress, which is called a distant stress. So if something happens to you, let's say you're abused as a child or you witnessed something horrific, or you were in a war, for example, then you can have the original event, which is very stressful. It happens, the stress response goes up and then it goes back down to normal. But then later on, you can have a trigger that can then recreate that a very similar stress response again. And so it can just recur and recur and recur again. So this would be a classic symptom of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. But this we would term a distant stress response. So again, so those last two, they're never good. But generally speaking, the stress response is a normal, healthy reaction, and a brief stressful event, some of those ones that in the earlier part of those examples, it triggers helpful infection fighting chemicals, which can be invigorating, whereas long-term trauma, such as chronic and distant stresses, can actually have have negative effects. It causes your white blood cells, your virus attacking white blood cells, to stop multiplying and can even lead to several stress-related mental and physical conditions, including diabetes. It is also linked to obesity. So the question I ask you is, are we all really getting stressed? Now, I've kind of often thought about this. How do I answer that question? I would say that, and what I've looked into is, there's no evidence that the lives that we are living now would end up greater number of stressors than at any other time in the past. You know, you think back about wars and famine and things that we have had to endure. So I don't think, I've not found any evidence to show that we're actually more stressed in the sense of the stresses that are put upon us. But I think that we've clouded all this idea of what stress is. And it's maybe that we become more aware of this concept of stress. But I think it helps you if you understand that, you know, what I maybe assume as stress maybe isn't what I thought it was. So is it bad for me? Is this stress response bad for me? Now, I want to give you an image. So let's imagine that you have the demands placed upon you and the capacity that is upon you. I've represented this on a slide as being two circles, one with capacity and one with demands, and they're both the same size. And in this situation, the demands and the capacity are matched. The demands, capacity to fulfill them are matched. We can do this and we can cope with it. So what happens is the demand places upon us a periodic stress response. We then respond to that and we can meet those demands, and you end up with a healthy cycle. Actually, and a bit of stress gives you high energy levels and well-being, and you can manage those demands. So that's when they're balanced. If it's not, so if the demand exceeds your perceived capacity, and it's important, it's your perceived capacity, so it's what you think you are capable of. If you feel that you're not capable of meeting this demand, then it is uneven. And rather than having a brief stress response, you have this overblown stress response, and actually you don't respond to it positively, and your ability to work decreases over time. So actually your demands can increase, and you end up in this vicious cycle of things getting worse, and ultimately you'll end up getting very unwell. So as this overblown stress response reduces your ability to deal with the demands, so, and actually it harms your health, reduced health, if you end up in this situation. So what can happen to us if this situation happens is stress bad for me? Then yes, it is. In these situations, the body's fight or flight response is essentially a primal sledgehammer reaction that was a lifesaver for fending off predators, but it's a sledgehammer for cracking a nut with the day-to-day situations that we deal with now. It is useful if you're under threat and you've got to run away. All those bodily responses are ideal. But if, you know, you and I are sat working, we're under pressure, and we've got stress to do, then the stress response will often be inappropriate for the situation that we're in. We end up with those stress responses that I've mentioned before that are not healthy. So the impacts on it, I like to call the wheel of misfortune, of different things that can culminate in our body. And it's worth being aware of this and paying attention to the effects of stress, because many of us might think, you know, I handle stress really well. And that may be true, but these chronic stresses, they will take a toll on the body. The research backs this up very strongly. So working around the wheel of misfortune, you find that the brain is stuck in a highly vigilant watching network. There's various different brain networks in which our brain operates in. So we can be concentrating on something, that's when the frontal lobes are activated and we're thinking, we're concentrating, we're working on a task. If when we're relaxed, our mind is wandering. And at that point, our brain is in this wandering network that's called the default mode network. When we're paying attention, you know, like, so you're sat at the traffic lights, you're waiting for it to go from red to green, you're paying attention, and that are circuits in the brain called the salience network, or the watching network, as I call it. And when your stress response and your fight or flight response kicks in, your brain automatically goes into that watching network, that I'm paying attention, I'm focused on this thing. But if you're constantly undergoing the stress response, then you get stuck. You're constantly going into this this salience network, this watching mode of brain operation, and that takes its toll and can result in persistently low mood, anxiety, and destructive thought patterns. So actually, it changes the way in which your brain operates. Your immune system is tipped off balance, as I mentioned, causing the bone marrow to pump out white blood cells that actually fur up the arteries and worsen allergies. It increases your likelihood of your arteries furring up, a condition called atherosclerosis. When we are under stress, your body responds in this very self-destructive way. The helpful stress hormone called cortisol, which is, and actually this is a hormone that gives you a sense of lift. It's the thing that gets you out of bed in the morning. When you wake up in the morning, the alarm goes off. The only thing that really gets you out of bed is this hormone called cortisol. It's the thing that raises your blood pressure. It gets you going in the morning. If you are constantly stressed, though, then you don't get that natural boost in the morning. You don't get the cortisol. And actually, you can wake up. Actually, it's one reason why you don't want to get out of bed if you're constantly stressed, is that you're essentially becoming burnt out. Your body clock rhythms get affected, become muted. You don't have the normal ebb and flow of the day. You end up just being fatigued. It disrupts your sleeping patterns, and that ultimately again becomes a vicious cycle of harm against you. It's just in the fuel stores, because you're under, your body has been programmed, it's genetically evolved to survive horrendous conditions. So famine, for example, will be a classical place in which we will be under threat, we'll be under stress. And so our body is geared towards holding on to our reserves. So fuel stores will actually, your fuel stores will then have surplus energy, and then it will accumulate as fat, and that classically will be around the internal organs as a result of stress. So, you know, you see it more often is that around the gut, that is where that's the fat that accumulates around the organs, and that is very much associated with chronic stress. And the constant flow of the energizing hormone adrenaline and cortisol slows down your digestive and your digestive system. And that's because when you're under attack, when you're under threat, your eating is not something that you need to worry about. So it shuts down. Actually, constant stress leads to a variety of digestive symptoms and is a major contributor to irritable bowel syndrome. So blood is diverted from the digestive system towards the muscles. So you lose appetite and you get indigestion, as well as these more chronic, these longer lasting digestive problems. Your heart rate, blood pressure, breathing are constantly elevated, risking health problems such as heart attack and stroke. So is there a quick way to calm my nerves? So I'm just going to tell you, this is how you hack your stress response. When you understand it, you will hopefully you'll think that this is actually a very good thing to do. So in your brain, there's as I mentioned earlier, there's a little spot called the amygdala. It's very small. It's kind of almond shaped, and that's where it gets its name from, amygdala. And this part of the brain is constantly alert, it's constantly on. So at nighttime, when you're sleeping, if something comes into your room or a sound, you know, picture falls off the wall downstairs, you wake up with a start. And that's because the amygdala is always on there day and night. It's looking out for threats. And this is the thing that, when it's activated, drives the fight or flight and the stress response. So that is the seat of all these stress responses, is this part of the brain called the amygdala. Now, I'm going to introduce to you a concept that you may have not heard before, and that is a sense that we all have. It's called interoception. It's a little known sense that is your mind's sense of what's happening to your body. All the time, unconsciously, our brain is picking up signals from throughout our body, from the blood vessels, from the skin, from the joints, from the muscles, from all different organs and tissues. And we're not aware of this, but our brain is constantly picking up these inputs from and is assimilating that into our emotions, into how we feel about ourselves and about the world. And the stress response, it's particularly attuned, the amygdala is particularly attuned to these features of the stress response. So the fast breathing, the increased heart rate, sweating, they're all things that cue your brain and your amygdala to go, I'm under threat. So, but the thing is, as you think about this, is that these are all out of your control. You can't really control what your blood pressure is doing, how hard your heart is working. But there's one part of the stress response that you can control. You can't control how your pupils dilate. You can't really control your digestion slowing down. You can't stop yourself sweating. But there is one thing that you can control that is your breathing. You can slow down your breathing consciously. And that is one of the cues, or one of the things that your interoception, the brain, the inward looking eye, is paying attention to. It's the breathing. And by slowing down the breathing, by consciously using your frontal lobes, using your person, your personality, you can slow down your breathing. And when your breathing slows down, your lungs, the rate is slowing, and there's a nerve that sends signals back from the lungs back to the brain called the vagus nerve. And if you're slowing your lungs down, then this essentially sends calming signals back to the amygdala. So it goes all the way back to the amygdala, and then that what scales down, dials down the stress response. And so rather than getting an ever decreasing worsening cycle, you're actually starting to calm everything down. So it's a really good thing to do. I find it is that just slowing your breathing down. And, you know, I was often told that, you know, just deep breaths, that'll help you. And I always thought, that's never going to do anything. But actually, when you realize that I have this sense inside of me, this thing where my brain, this interoception, it is paying attention to what's going on in my body. So another thing that you can do is that your muscles will tense when, and if you sit down, if you feel your body, you might think, is there anywhere in my body that's tense? What's my rate of my breathing? These are things that I can control, and relate that to how you're feeling, your emotions. And by changing the rate of breathing and relaxing your muscles, that can have a powerful effect on your anxiety levels, your stress levels, and how your body responds. I'm going to talk about thoughts. How can I manage worrying thoughts? And worrying thoughts, they will, about an impending event, will actually ramp up your amygdala's sensitivity, causing into a cycle of fretful ruminations that essentially play out on repeat. Your brain becomes like a washing machine going round and round and round. And this is, so the thoughts that we have, the I wonder what's going to happen, the fretting about the future, that is dialing up our amygdala to be on high alert. And as it does that, when your amygdala is turned on and you're in the salience network, as I said, you're focused on something, the thinking part of your brain, the frontal, the concentrating, also called the executive network, the area of the brain, that basically shuts down. So you can't think more clearly. You get repeated irrational fears, and you're leaving to fret over impossible catastrophes and imagined arguments, things that just, you know, it goes round and round your head, and you end up in this worsening situation. So the thoughts feed into the amygdala very much. So there's some suggestions here that I can suggest about calming those thoughts so that we don't fire up our amygdala, that we don't get this whole stress response sparking off. One thing is to rehearse calm patterns of thinking long before the amygdala anticipates a threat, so you can calm out a familiar, peaceful pathway in the brain to allay anxiety. So you may have heard it said that neurons, brain cells that fire together, wire together. And I kind of liken it to walking through a field. Is the first time you walk through a field, you can't see the path, but over time you will form yourself a trail of every time you walk down it. You're trampling down the grass or whatever it is that is in the field, and your path becomes clear. The same happens with our brain, with the pathways in our brain, that when we use it once, it's easily forgotten, but when we rehearse things over and over again, they become a set thing that become very familiar. And by rehearsing calm patterns of thinking, You might do this through mindfulness, through meditation, through rehearsing. Imagine yourselves in your favorite place, and you can rehearse these things. Sometimes people can do a tapping. So you can rehearse, when I tap, I'm going to start thinking about calming thoughts. I'm going to tell myself that I love myself. I'm going to tell myself that I'm going to think, I'm in a safe place. I'm back in my bedroom or wherever it is. I'm on a beach. And you can tell yourself, and you rehearse that when you're calm, when you're relaxed, and when you're in that situation, you can go through that same motion again, slow your breathing down, and that can help calm the thoughts and then bring you back, bring the frontal thinking part of your brain back into action. Another way of getting the frontal part of your brain, of your personality, of you, back into action and turning off this primal threat response is to do something, do a puzzle, Do something. It can be do some sums, do some calculations, do something that brings you into the here and now. Any kind of problem solving thing. Do the crossword, do something like that. Or the things that find something tangible, focus on something outside of yourself. Even if it's about counting the leaves on a plant, will help you have calmer pattern of thinking. So there's some thoughts for you, some little sort of tidbits, some tips of things that you can do that you can practice, so that when you're fretting that something terrible is going to happen, when you're worrying about the exam, when you're worrying about the wedding day, what's going to happen, and that cycle starting, is that you can do these things. You can rehearse beforehand when you're calm, in an evening. You can practice calm thinking patterns. You can rehearse it in that moment. You can then try and do something tangible. You can go, I'm going to take my mind off of this. I'm going to do something that brings me into the here and now, not the thinking of, what might happen, because a lot of the time those things will never actually happen. How can I deal with constant stress? I'm going to give you something that I found very helpful, is that when we're thinking about our capacity and the demands upon us, it's very useful to think about our lives as being like in a scales. And on one side of the scales, we have the demands, the things, the pressures that are put on us. On the other side, we've got the things that build us up, that give us our reserves, that give us our resilience. So if we imagine a set of scales, and on one side we have the demands on us. So here I've given you, let's say it's interruptions. So interruptions from your phone the whole time, that is a demand, that is a stressor on you. You've got work, for example, and then you've got delays. You're trying to get somewhere, you're being held up, the computer's not working, there's a delay, trains aren't working. All these things are stressors upon you. And let's say that in this instance, the thing that gives you, that refreshes you, that restores you, that gives you a sense of well-being is exercise. Then you would have exercise on that side of the scales. But what can we do to help with us in this situation? Is there anything that we can take off the demands side of the scales? So we've got work, we've got delays, and we've got interruptions in this example. So let's say that we get rid of the interruptions by, turning off the announcements, the notifications on our phone, or turning off the emails on a computer, then that is one less stressor on us. And why not pile up the things on the things that help us, the things that we know build us up, that lift us up? So, maybe it is exercise, maybe it's being creative, playing an instrument, maybe it's acts of kindness, generosity and thankfulness. They are some of the most powerful things for mental well-being. We often hear it said, and a lot of it will be focused about yourself and solving your own issues and looking inside yourself, but actually one of the most healing things, and this is not just sort of hand-waving nonsense, this is backed up by good research, is generosity and thankfulness. There is good research to show that at the end of every day, if you keep a gratitude journal, and I do this, I've got a little app on my phone, is the end of every day, there's a little pop-up comes along and says, reminds me to write something thankful on it. And I just, at the end of the day, before I go to bed, I put something in there. And that has a profound effect on the way you see the world and the way you see yourself. And being sociable, socializing, being with others, we are evolved as social creatures. The reasons why we are here is that we're social and that we're born to do that. We're born to be with other people. And interestingly, research shows that the boost that we get from being social, you get it with being face to face, but you don't get the same one by texting. It's got to be, phone calls are better than texting, but actually there needs to be some kind of interaction rather than being something that's just text based to get the fulfillment, the lift, the restorative effects that you get from meeting with other people. So there's a whistle stop tour through, are we really getting more stress? And I've explained to you what stress is. And I think it's our misconception about what stress is that often makes us think that everybody's getting more stressed. Is it bad for me? Short-term stress can be invigorating. We need some stress in our life. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't do much. So it is good for you. But when it's chronic, as in it's long-term, it comes and goes, or it's recurrent, or we're reliving something from the past, or it's something like a bereavement, but the stress goes on for a long, long time. Anything that is a prolonged stress, because this stress response is designed to get us out of an emergency situation. Our body isn't built for us to be able to maintain it for months and weeks at a time. Is there a quick way to calm my nerves? Yes, you can hack your stress response by slowing down your breathing, using that, now I've taught you, that sense called interoception to talk to yourself by using your body. How can I manage worrying thoughts? I've given you some tips there on how you can rehearse getting yourself out of a worrying situation, how you can bring yourself back into the here and now. Mindfulness can be a very good way in which to bring yourself into the moment, not be thinking about the future. Think about the future often causes us to be anxious. Thinking about the past often makes us feel depressed, but it actually brings us into the now. And actually, this is how we are, and this is okay, and this is me right now. How can I deal with constant stress? And I've said to you, look at it at the scales. What can you put? What's going to resource you? Do things that resource you and take things off that it demands, all the things that you can, because you can probably find that there are some things that are weighing you down that you can chuck off really easily. So that is my whistle stop tour through stress. And I hope that's helpful to you. I'll take some questions now, if that's possible.
Great. Thank you very much. We have a couple questions already. So one question is, how do you cope with chronic stress of self-blame and the notion of changing the world with zero power? Does this seem normal, or the person has already crossed the threshold of reasonable, healthy stress?
How do you cope with chronic stress of self-blame and the notion of changing the world with zero power? Now, what I would say is that a lot of these things, a lot of the causes of our stress are very deep-seated. And actually we can't solve them there's no easy, real, simple solution. You can't read a book and get an answer to it. What I would say, and it's been profound with me, is counseling, is getting somebody, or a therapist, somebody who is trained to go through these things to actually explore where the roots of the way that you are come from. Because this concept of having zero power, for example, that will have come from somewhere that you believe that you have zero power in a situation. That's just one example, but you will need somebody to go through that with you to explore that, I would suggest. I was in a very bad place when I was in medical school. I ended up having an eating disorder. And for years I was plagued with that. I only got through it through counseling for many years. And, these things, all of us have burdens that we carry. All of us have weaknesses. All of us have things that we don't like about ourselves, but you don't have to live with that. And that you can, the brain is highly malleable. When I was training as a doctor, I was told that your personality is fixed. When you get to your mid-teens, when you've gone through puberty and you've gone through adolescence, your personality then is fixed and unchanging. Whatever your traits are then, you're not going to change it. And that's just who you are. That's your character. So when you take personality tests, it's going to be the same when you're 20, when you're 30, when you're 40. We now know that that isn't true at all. The brain is highly malleable, that you can rewire, it can rework. I could show you a picture of my brain where I had a brain tumor. I've had surgery and I've had a significant problem about this much of my brain taken out. And, you know, my brain reforms. I'm still me. And just shows the incredible capacity of the brain to reform. And in the same way, our stuck ways of thinking, those pathways that have been trodden time and time again in our mind, in our thinking, they can be changed. So not a quick and easy answer for you, but hopefully that's good. So other questions?
I think what is important to realize that many of these issues can be dealt with, as you said, with seeking professional advice and counseling. Mm-hmm. And many people benefit from, you know, such professional help and recover very well. So, I encourage people to pursue this.
Haifa sent a really interesting question. Hi, Haifa. Hello from Germany. Hello from the UK. Beta blockers are used by many people to overcome short stress. What do you think about that? Well, from today, you can probably work out why is it that people are given beta blockers, and beta blockers slow the heart down, because you can't slow your heart down, but taking a drug will slow your heart down. And that will then send that message to your amygdala to wind down the response, wind down that fight or flight thing. What you don't need to, your body isn't actually under that much demand. It's this strange two-way thing. Body and mind, they talk to each other all the time. We just think that we're brain and we're body, but we're not, the two work together. How can the food fight the stress? That's really interesting. Food is a very rewarding thing. So food, when we have food and it's pleasurable, we have a rush of this thing called dopamine, which is the feel good, the reward hormone. It's the same feeling that we get after we've been on a roller coaster, after we've won an award, after we've had a good well done from our boss. It's the same reward after, you know, after having sex. It's that uplifting. It's that thing that gets people addicted to stuff. A food gives us that feeling, it gives us that reward, we get the dopamine rush. So that is how food fights stress, in that it gives you a momentary relief. So you probably understand from that it's obviously not a good solution to stress, because it is momentary. It gives you that momentary dopamine rush, but doesn't solve the stress, doesn't solve the stresses, this thing that's causing you to have the stress response. And we've got some more, have we?
Yeah. Need them or?
So Leahard, have I missed one above there? So there's one from, so I'm going to say, what
is one on, do you have any suggestions how to approach the institutions rather than the individuals about the stress coping strategies? Well, how much of this is things that, you know, self-inflicted or can be dealt with at an individual level versus things that, you know, stress will come from sort of the working environment or other institutions in society?
How to approach the institutions rather than individual about stress coping strategies. I'm not sure if I completely understand the question.
I think the point is, you in the book and your discussion, you sort of reflect on a stress from an individual point of view, right?
Yeah.
How do we perceive it? How do we manage it? How do we respond to it? And the question maybe relates to whether that's sufficient or whether one needs to address the stressors that are, you know, in the environment. In this case, I assume one is referring to either societal norms or societal pressure or institutional stressors.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did support in the book is that absolutely you. Control everything that you can control in yourself, but then believe that you can take actions to remove those undue demands on you. Like I've suggested, you know, very simple. And as I just said, get rid of your interruptions. But you're in an institution, you can have a degree of control over your situation. You can exert influence. You can tell people that this is, you know, this isn't right. This isn't working. I'm finding this increasingly difficult. Would it be a good idea if we did this in this way? You can manipulate your environment, your workspace too. And, you know, work with other people on that, because you want an environment that isn't conducive to chronic stress. Is that kind of where we're going with that?
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, cool.
The second question is about resilience. And do you think that too much resilience can be a negative thing? Because I could imagine people sticking, for example, to meditation, while they should actually be working on changing their lives.
I see what you mean. For example, that's a great question. Are we hiding from our problems by just going in on ourselves and actually not facing up to the issue? Are we just saying, I can deal with this myself? You know, I just got to sort out my own stress. You're giving the example of a toxic relationship. Of course, that's a real big danger. And I want to, you know, temper everything that I say is that it isn't just about, you know, you can look after yourself. You know, I can encourage you that these are some tools for you to understand yourself a bit better and to deal with your side of things. But that is no reason to not deal with a dysfunctional, damaging situation or an environment, an institution that you're in that is harming you. I definitely don't want to say that. So it can be too much a resilience thing. I think we can put too much stress on, you know, it's all on me. I need to be more resilient person rather than these, you know. And I think these things are really important. You know, I mentioned before about as being social. I think that the power of being able to talk with other people, being able to share, being able to discuss things and see it from different angles is really important, that you're not in this on your own. So does that kind of help answer the question? You shouldn't just retreat to yourself.
I wanted to bring a point about the importance of socializing and in-person socializing. And I'd like you to elaborate on the point you say in the book that the symptoms of rejection and isolation are so similar to physical pain that they can even be relieved with painkillers.
Absolutely. It's remarkable, isn't it?
Powerful.
Remarkable, yeah. People who are going through grief, for example, then painkillers, study would show that painkillers actually diminish the pain of that grief. We shouldn't underestimate the pain, the emotional pain that we feel. It is real. You know, I hate this thing of that, you know, it doesn't matter because it's not, you know. You know, we talk about abuse and people who've suffered physical abuse are put in a place of so much worse than people who suffered emotional abuse, because we consider that physical harm, bruises, injuries are of more value than those that are emotional. And actually, bruises and broken bones will heal, but the things inside can take much longer and can stay with us for, you know, with, you know, giving an example of post-traumatic stress disorder, it can live with us for far longer. So I think in response to that, yes, socializing can be very healing, but the emotional pain of and rejection and of loneliness and separation, it is a real pain.
So there's one question about a new type of stress. It's called eco-anxiety.
Eco-anxiety.
That is the general stress caused by the climate crisis that's especially felt by the younger generations. Do we classify this, you know, where do you classify this on the different types of stress or along this?
I mean, it can kind of be useful for people to you know, like journalists when they're going to write about things. It's kind of quite nice to pigeonhole things, but it's not a unique stress in and of itself. It's one of these things from outside that we often feel very helpless about, because, and I would say this, I spoke to a very interesting cognitive neuroscientist, and he told me that he never reads the news. And I said to him, I said, why do you never read the news? He said, well, it doesn't impact me. It just makes me feel bad when I read the news. You know, it has no impact on my life. And I said to him, actually, no, I like being informed. I like to know what's going on. Actually, there are instances when, you know, especially with COVID, I spoke to this was before COVID had happened, where actually the news is really important to actually to let you know what's going on and what you've got to do. But it is, you know, I think advice that I give is that, especially talk about in the morning, I think the morning is a really important first part of your day, is that in the morning, the first 30 minutes after waking, your brain hasn't yet fired up. You're suffering a thing called sleep inertia, where your brain essentially just keeps slipping back into sleepness. And in that time, you can't make decisions very well. So I say to people is that first thing in the morning, don't look at your, if you've got your phone, don't look at the news on it. Don't look at work emails, anything like that. Probably don't even go on social media. Just only if you're going to use it for the most calming, relaxing things. Play some nice music, or if you've got a meditation app or something like that, use that, because you won't, you're in this very vulnerable state. You can't deal with new information very well. And so I think news very much falls into that, is that especially first thing in the morning, we can't keep perspective on things. We jump to conclusions. We can't make decisions. There's very good research to show that when we're suffering sleep inertia, we can't make good decisions. We will get emotional, we'll get anxious about something unduly. So, yeah.
The brain's golden hour, the morning.
The brain's golden hour. I think not for making decisions. I find that waking up in the morning and being creative and writing,
exactly.
I find that very good. But in terms of if you've got to make difficult decisions, wait at least half an hour after getting out of bed. Do something first half an hour, you know, make yourself a cup of something, you know, have a shower, something, just, you know, enjoy the sunrise, something like that. And then deal with, don't turn off the notifications in the morning for news and everything. That would be my recommendation.
So if you allow me, you know, we've talked a lot sort of to get a little bit personal with respect to stress, because I think you mentioned this before. I mentioned this in the introduction. Mm. You know, as a young person, you spent a lot of your time studying hard, working to excel, to make it to medical school. You made it to medical school, you became a doctor, and all of a sudden you were diagnosed with this brain tumor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that must have been a very stressful period, you know, especially when recognizing that now you can no longer practice, you know, the thing you love to do. So could you, it's such an inspiring story, the transformation that you've been able to go through, you know, and just keep moving forward and reinventing yourself and redefining and re-identifying, you know, your passion. You know, could you just walk us through this period, sort of how did you manage those challenges, the stress and the anxiety, everything that came? And what were the empowering things or empowering moments that helped you pull through and keep moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's been some very dark times. And I think that throughout it all, I owe a lot of it to the people around me, you know, my family, my friends, the people who supported me, you know, no man's an island. And time and again, we know that the more of a social network you have around you, the better you will stand the challenges that we face. So I spent a lot of time talking about stress and what you can do for yourself, but it's not just about you, it's about the people around that you have to support the people around you. In terms of me personally, though, I went through a period of being very low, especially in the 6 months after I was diagnosed. I got to a point where I was actually forming plans as to how I might kill myself, and at that point I realized, no, this isn't healthy. When it starts to get, you know, I know we all have these thoughts from time to time, oh, I wish I wasn't here, but I think when it gets to the point of you forming plans, that's when I just think, no, I can't do this anymore. I told my GP, and so I have had antidepressants, and I found that they're very helpful. About 6 or 8 weeks after starting, the just sort of the lows weren't as low. The highs aren't as high, but at least I wasn't as low as I was. And so that very much got me through it. Lots of counselling has helped along the way. I think I wouldn't, can recommend it stronger, the importance of getting professional help with all these things. They're things that help. And I think you realize, I mean, I was 25, I think I was when I was diagnosed, is that all these things that you hold dear, you know, our identity, you know, that I'm a doctor, that you're an academic, that you're a professor, this is what you do, this is how people see you, this is how you value yourself, like it or not. But when that is stripped away, and often this only happens at the end of people's lives, and this is why I know that palliative care doctors, they find it such a rewarding profession to be in, because you're with people when the layers of the onion get peeled off, when all of a sudden we realize that this thing that I thought was important isn't. What is actually really important to me? What am I? Who am I? You know, all my deep down inside, who am I? What's important to me? You know, you know, I'm a husband, I'm a son, all these things, I'm a brother. These are things actually are more important. What is it about me that is who I am? And I think when you have that happen to you and then you get to the core of what is my identity, what is really important, how do I want to spend my days on this planet, that can bring you a great deal of peace. And then you can feel more positive about life and you know where you're going with life. So that's sort of, you know, but it's been a very long journey.
It's a lot about reconnecting with oneself and surrounding yourself by, you know, people who are very supportive and care for you.
Yeah, and I think knowing yourself, being kind to yourself are important things. Is to, yeah, I think we're often very harsh on ourselves, and we think we should be doing more, we think we should be better, but actually I think just a healthy dose of realism, just realizing that this is who I am, this is where I'm at, and if the situation is rubbish, just saying the situation is rubbish, or using stronger language than that and just being real about it. I think we've are we frozen?
Excellent. So thank you very much for your excellent presentation today. And I think all of us learned a lot, and I really liked many questions. And perhaps I would like to sort of ask the question, which is really close to a couple of them we had in the beginning, and then a little bit further down, which with regards to these larger pressures on especially younger generations when it comes to global challenges. And when we wake up in the morning, we always are thinking about them. So how would you reconceptualize it so we're not internalizing it, but actually dealing with it a bit better?
In terms of people, younger generations dealing with sort of the climate change situation. Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I always think it's good to control the things that you can control and don't worry about the things that you can't control. I think that's a good, you know, other things that you might. I also think it's about having hope and being positive in all situations. I think that they're things that I think are really important. I think when we're dealing with these huge sort of existential things with climate change and this constant drip, drip, drip of this threat against us, it's really hard and there are no easy solutions to it, you know. But I would say, I guess you've got to look after yourself, you've got to do what you can. And I think hope, you know, from my own personal journey, is that you should never lose hope, because I should be dead by now. You know, people say, you know, and people say doom and gloom with the world. I say, yes, it may all be that way, but people who are hopeful and optimistic, they live longer than those who are pessimistic. So if nothing else, be hopeful and optimistic, because you'll live longer and you'll be healthier.
Excellent. And I think that's a brilliant note to end on our webinar today. So thank you again, Dr. Stuart Fireman, for your talk. And thank you, Dr. Hiala Shuel, as well.
Thank you for the questions. Great questions.
And thank you to all of our listeners and viewers. And join us next time.